Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Minnie Corte is Vice President of Impact and Innovation for Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington. She earned her PhD in linguistics at Georgetown University and embarked on a career working in the nonprofit organization management industry. Her research has been featured on the front page of the Washington Post, she's been a guest on NPR, and she was the primary field researcher for the first publicly accessible corpus of regional African American language, funded by the National Science Foundation. Topics discussed include sociolinguistics, storytelling, data management, networking, nonprofit, disabilities, adjuncting, organization management, and nonlinear paths. Links to Minnie's LinkedIn profile and other resources mentioned are in the show notes. I am so delighted to welcome Minnie Corte to the podcast today. Minnie was a wonderful panelist at LCL 2021, and she has very graciously agreed to come back and talk about her journey from academia into industry. She is one of the few people I know who's been employed at a job for more than 10 years, so that's really amazing. So thanks, Minnie. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I can't tell you how excited I am to be here and to talk with you, Laurel, and to our community. It's just an honor. So I appreciate the invitation.
Sure. So first question that I always ask everybody, how did you get interested in linguistics?
So one of the things I did at my dissertation defense, I was very unconventional. I actually told this story because the person that got me interested in linguistics was in the room. So this is going to sound silly, but I didn't even know what linguistics was when I went to college. I had no clue what a linguistic, nothing. I had never even heard of the word.
That is so common. I mean, of all the people that I've talked to for this podcast, so many of them went to undergraduate not knowing and even finishing their undergraduate degree without knowing what it was. So you are not alone there.
Okay, good. I'm glad. So what happened was I applied to Georgetown and I got in, and I went because I was like, I'm going to be the first Black president of the United States. Now, mind you, life has a lot of things have happened since then and may be happening, so that those boxes have been checked. I don't have to worry about that.
You could be the second.
I can be
one.
The second. So what happened was when I did my first government class, and I was like, oh my God, who's going to do this for 4 years? It wasn't for me. I hated it, actually. Mm. And so the next semester, I had to take one of my prerequisites, and there was a linguistics class that met literally down the hall. And the other requirement was it didn't meet on Fridays. And I said, oh, well, this could be fun. I have no clue what this is. And I walked into the class, and I instantly fell in love. Uh-huh. And there was a professor there, Raph Fasold, who I didn't know was an amazing scholar in the field. And so I say I found linguistics by accident, but I stayed on purpose and with the purpose. Mm-hmm. And so that first semester I took the class, and that was the first time as a Black woman from the South that I felt that my linguistic identity was affirmed as a Southern speaker who's often considered the drawl and, mm-hmm. and you know, less intelligent as a Black woman, as a Black person who comes in with my own, you know, various varieties, not only my academic mainstream American English varieties, but also my African American language variety. Mm-hmm. And as well as being a woman and all of the things that come along with gendered language. And so for the first time, I understood all of those pieces and all of those intersections of my identity. And I felt so affirmed. And so the next semester, I took another class and another class and another class. And then ultimately, I got a major in linguistics. And then I did an accelerated master's in theoretical linguistics. And then obviously, and then I've done a PhD in sociolinguistics.
Mm. Wow, that's amazing. I think your experience is very similar to mine and many other people, that you don't know about linguistics and then you start taking linguistics classes and you do literally fall in love. Like, this is the thing for me. It just speaks to you in such an amazing, deep way for all the reasons that you were talking about. It's amazing. I often compare it to, you know, when people talk about their experiences about choosing a major And they'd speak about it in very like, well, this seemed like a good thing. And for me, linguistics was like, this is it. I don't want to do anything else. It was really different.
That was me. And the other piece that I did along with linguistics was I did theater. But they coupled to me, it was a beautiful marriage. Linguistics told you, it taught me how to one, understand the workings of language and the scientific study of the language, obviously, but also how to use language in different ways. And when you're in theater and you're in performance, I was in performing arts. That's exactly what you do when you take on these characters, right? You voice them in a way. And I think when I was learning about the different varieties and the different accents and the different dialects, especially in the United States, when I took those classes, I was like, these two things work for me. And so it seemed to be a perfect marriage of linguistics and theater for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so cool. So your journey through graduate school, was that just like out of undergraduate into graduate school and then finishing your PhD, or were there little turns along the way?
Not little turns. We had big U-turns.
Okay.
We had big detours, just stop on the side of the road. Like, we had all the things, right? If we want to use the car metaphor, I broke down a few times. I had to get a new car, had to get the tow truck, all the things, right, happened. But I think they made the journey worth it. So if you don't mind, I'll tell you kind of how I got to.
Yeah, please.
So one of the things is very early on, I always knew that I was going to get a PhD. And nobody in my family had a PhD, but I just knew that it was one of those things, whatever I start, I'm going to finish. And, and so PhD was a terminal degree, and I didn't even know what the implications of getting a PhD. I didn't know any of that, right? Because I hadn't had people in my space that had that, but I said, I'm going to do it anyway. And so, when I left Georgetown, one of the other things I knew, I fell in love with Georgetown. So I knew I wanted to teach at Georgetown. But it's often frowned upon, if you will, in a lot of cases, for you to ultimately teach at the institution in which you received your degree. Mm-hmm. And so I was very intentional when I started my graduate studies or my doctoral studies not to apply to Georgetown, because I knew I wanted to come back and teach at Georgetown.
Okay, interesting. All right, yeah.
And ultimately, I found that that's true in some spaces, but not all. And so I went to Michigan State and I got to work with the incomparable, inimitable Dr. Geneva Smitherman. Totally changed my life. I want to put a pin in that because I'm going to talk about what that meant to have her mentorship. And I went to Michigan State, started there in 2006. And I was newly married at the time. And super excited. And then in 2010, I found out I was pregnant with my daughter. And it was, I was so excited to be pregnant, but my body did not like pregnancy. And I was sick from week six of my pregnancy to delivering 13 weeks early. Oh, I just had a really rough go. And so life happened, literally and figuratively. And I left the academy. I left Michigan State and I just ended my doctoral journey altogether. And at that time, my daughter was in the hospital. She was born 3 months early and we were in the hospital for 3 months. And then she contracted meningitis. And
oh,
so we
my
went.
God.
After we got out of the hospital, we were out of the hospital for 13 days. And then we had to go back to the hospital for another 6 weeks because of the meningitis in ICU for 3 of those 6 weeks. And so it was a really, really tough journey. And during that process, or soon after, I was also going through a divorce, right? So my priorities most definitely shifted from doctoral studies to mommyhood and to surviving and to figuring it out, like figuring out this whole dream I had to kind of put it. I actually let it go. I didn't even put it on hold. I just said, that's not where I need to be focused. And so let's fast forward to 2012. And one of my good friends from undergrad, he was on the board of Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington. He was on one of the regional boards and he called me. He says, I know you're trying to put the pieces of your life back together and there's a position available. I think you would be really good at it. You should apply. And I was like, oh, okay. And I talked to my mom and she's like, I really think this is a good opportunity. She's like, you love DC and you need to get back to building a life for you and your daughter. And so I applied for the position and I didn't get the position. And I was heartbroken, kind of, but I was like, well, that clearly wasn't for me. But lo and behold, there was something else was brewing. So 2 months later, I ended up being the supervisor of the original position I applied for.
Okay.
And so I moved to DC. And I remember, and I moved to DC in November. And I got there and I was like, okay, this is going to be great. Everything, you know, I'm excited. And I remember telling myself, and I remember watching my daughter fight for her life and all the things. And I remember telling myself, I can't look her in the face and say, you have to finish what you started if I don't do this thing, if I don't finish this PhD. So mind you, this is mid-November. Applications are due at the beginning of December. Mm-hmm. I reached out to Georgetown and I said, hey, I'm super interested in coming back. I reached out to Dr. Natalie Schilling, who had mm-hmm. worked really closely with me during my undergrad and my master's. And she's like, we would love to have you back. Applications are due in 2 weeks, however. Can you get everything done? I was like, I'm going to work as hard as I can to get my application in. My GREs had just expired a few months before that. So I had to take the GRE.
Oh, no. The worst.
A recommendation. And I had to do the whole, you know, my statement. But I got everything in. And then I was luckily afforded an opportunity to join for the next fall. And I was super, super excited. So then I rejoined. I joined the Georgetown Linguistics Department in August of 2013. And then just to let you know that sometimes, once again, going back to those detours and those stops, and I officially graduated from Georgetown August 2023. So it took me 10 years of lifing and being on this course, but I finished. And so that's my doctoral journey. And there are a lot of pieces in there that we can tease apart. But it really was, after I graduated in 2005, I did the accelerated master's in 2006, went to Michigan State for 4 years. Then I had to leave, came to Georgetown, and it took me about 10 years with a couple of pauses in between to mm-hmm. finish up. But I'm here and I finished.
Wow, that's amazing. So just to be clear, were you working the time that you were in the doctoral program at Georgetown?
I actually started the job a year before I actually was officially enrolled. So I was full time. Wow. The whole time I was doing the PhD at Georgetown.
Wow, that is amazing. I think that's pretty unusual. And of course, it took you longer to finish because you were working the whole time. That is a really inspirational story. So for people who are listening, it is possible. Here's the example of someone who did it. And I think that, you know, your view on this, I mean, you're so practical in the way that you were thinking about it, where you wanted to live and what was going to be best for you. And then just accepting the fact that, like, hey, I'm not going to finish this PhD in 4 years or 6 years. It's going to take as long as it's going to take. And that's okay.
Yeah, I say it's about get the W-I-N and stop focusing on the W-H-E-N, right? You got to get the win. And I'm not saying don't have the date in mind, but focus on the getting the win and not when you're going mm-hmm. to get it. Because you can change the date. You just don't change the dream.
Right.
And that was one of my models. I know it probably made my committee, it was exhausting and I know I got on their nerves, but I appreciate Natalie Schilling, Jen Neese, and Heidi Hamilton for sticking with me through all of it, through the sicknesses, and we can talk about that as well, through working and trying to navigate through COVID, through, I had mm-hmm. a couple of surgeries in there, like life really happened. And yeah. I appreciate those women. They stuck with me. And I know I was frustrating to them, but they did walk with me through that journey, even though it took me a little longer than some of their other students.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. So now I have to ask you, As you were coming to the end of your PhD, did you think you were going to work in academia, or I mean, you're working full time, or were you thinking your degree was really going to help you in the industry or the company where you were at the time?
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit of both and, right? Mm-hmm. So I have two very different life goals, and one is very untraditional. So, so as I tell your readers, be prepared for a little shock, and God rest her soul. I wanted to be the Black Dr. Ruth, right? I just think, I think talking about relationships and talking about intimacy and having conversations and frank conversations. I feel like I'm a pretty good listener, but also helping folks navigate through that. And I feel like I would be really good in that space. So that was my first life goal. And I know she just recently passed away. And then my second life goal was to be president of the university president of Spelman in Atlanta. And not because I went to Spelman, but I just think to see so many amazing young women of color doing amazing things and setting the world on fire, there was something about that that always resonated with me. And especially when I was in such a small community of color at Georgetown, just because of the, you know, it's a PWI. And so I think academia, so I was thinking about getting to the presidency in kind of a couple of different ways, right? You can go the faculty route. You can go, of course, the, you know, dean, and you can go the academic kind of leadership route. But you can also go the nonprofit executive leadership route.
Yeah.
And so ultimately I was like, if this is something I want to do, I still have this ability to kind of enter that space through this way. And I, to be quite honest, I think I got scared. I got scared of going into academia because I felt like I wasn't good enough. I felt like having to publish, you know, writing was hard for me. Like I can talk all day, right? And I can give a presentation on anything. But when it came to sit down and to put those ideas pen to paper, that was really tough for me. And so I worried about, am I going to publish enough? Am I going to, you know, am I going to be good enough? Am I going to get accepted in enough journals? And so I really... I said, you know what, maybe academia isn't for me, and maybe it is, but maybe not at, you know, a research one institution. It may be, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. And so I was like, maybe my space is being in a community college where you have non-traditional learners, because that moment when the light bulb clicks and they get it, that moment is magical to me. And so I said, you know, I don't know. We'll see what opportunities. But I knew that if I ultimately wanted to get to Spelman and I continued on in my trajectory with Boys and Girls Clubs and then whatever organization may come after that, I said that could be my ticket into the university presidency. And so that was really my driving force. And there have been a couple of positions open. But once again, I think it was that imposter syndrome and that fear that that swayed me initially. But then it was... I think I can affect and I can take my classroom beyond the traditional classroom. And so I then made a choice not to apply to a few positions that I thought I was a really good fit for. And I think that's in the space I'm in now, is I love adjuncting. I love being able to get my itch scratched, right? Teaching my class every year. I love that. And I think for me, that's enough at this point. When I think about the academy, I love being able to still go on campus and see students. I'm still very much involved in some very specific affinity groups and social justice groups at Georgetown. But I think that's enough connection for me at this point.
Yeah. Long term, do you still want to be a university president?
I think so. And my current CEO, she knows that dream, and she reminds me of it often. She's like, if you just let me answer the phones when you're president, I would love that, right? But I love that she's bought into that vision for me. And ultimately, if I don't become president of Spelman or of any university or college, what I do see is I see that dream is alive and people are feeding and fueling that and giving me opportunities to do that, even in my, you know, my non-academic job. And we can kind of talk about my journey at Boys and Girls Clubs, but I love that I've put it out there and I've really articulated what my big vision is. And they're finding ways to incorporate that goal and that vision into my current work.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Let's talk about your job. So you mentioned that the reason you knew about the existence of these jobs in the first place was through networking, essentially, right? Someone that you knew this job and said, I think you'd be good for it. And that led you to knowing about this organization, the Boys and Girls Club, and that's where you've been ever since. So, and you've had promotions, including a very recent one, which is great. So yeah, can you talk about your journey through that organization?
I can. So first of all, big shout out to Boys and Girls Clubs. The funny thing is I wasn't a Boys and Girls Club kid, but my brother was. And actually one of the folks that is one of my mentors in the field was my brother's youth development professional years and years ago. So when I tell you the world is small and the world is mighty and connections matter, they matter in that full circle. So I think when I came into the organization, I was new. I hadn't really held any full-time jobs outside of, I had done a lot of work, especially in the youth development space and pouring into young people, done a lot of tutoring, I had my own small nonprofit here in my local hometown that dealt with teenage girls. So I could speak a lot about how to shape a young person's development, but I had never worked a traditional, a grown-up job, as I call it, a 9-to-5. Uh-huh. And so when I got this role, I was over 6 clubs, right? I was deputy regional director, and I came into the organization, and the organization was going through some changes and some challenges. And so within my first couple of months, I had to deal with vandalism. Someone vandalized the front part of our club and one of the vans. I had to close a club, and I had to tell, kids that they would no longer have their club in their community and they would no longer have their staff. And the staff would no longer have a job in that area. But I also got to see some of the joys and some of the successes of what the club did. We had a young man, and he was the first generation, and he was a track runner, and he talked about how the club really gave him the opportunity to run and do something that he loves and helped him get to college because of it. Right. So it really gave me a sense of this is the right work, and I'm doing the right work at a really tough time. And how can I affect the work? But I realized operations in that space wasn't for me. So then there was an opportunity to switch over to data. And so after about 7 months, I was promoted to my first promotion, and I did that role for a very long time, actually. I was in that role for about seven, eight years, and I really helped create data systems for our current organization. And then at COVID, one of our longtime team members retired. And so we were thinking, how do we restructure the organization? What can we do? And so we created a new department that kind of brought in a lot of different pieces of the organization. And I was the first director of that. And then 2 years later, right, the week of my dissertation defense, actually, I was promoted to a new role with our CEO to really focus on strategic, leading our strategic plan for the organization and our organizational health. And our organizational kind of what's our status. So I focused on the KPIs and really how do we communicate our message and our impact to our board and to our stakeholders internally. And then as recent as this week, I am now the Vice President of Impact and Innovation. And so I get to work with really thinking about how do we continue to keep our programs fresh? How do we provide quality services to our young people? How do we tell our story through numbers and data? But also, how do we provide trauma-informed services to our young people? Because we know, especially post-COVID, but even taking COVID out of, we know that our young people and our staff come from, many of them experience different types of trauma. And you bring your full self to these spaces. And some days, some days you can function and you're fine. And other days, something can trigger. So making sure that we're being a safe space, a space that really envelops them. And so that's one of the initiatives also that I will be helping to support in this new role. So for those who are listening and who you're working hard and you're doing this PhD or you're doing this master's and you're like, what am I going to do? I have to go into academia. That's a great choice. If that's your choice, if that's your jam, go for it. And I love that for you. And I most definitely will be your biggest cheerleader. Can't wait for your articles to come out. Can't wait for your book to come out. But for the others of us who that didn't seem to be the right choice at the time that we had to make that decision, don't be afraid to do something different. Because one of the things about linguistics, and I say this all the time, linguists make the best everything, right? If you need a lawyer, if you have a linguist who is the best, they're going to make the best lawyer because they're going to listen to what you say, but also to what you don't say, right? Linguists make the best doctors because they're going to listen to what the patient is telling them, but also what the patient is not telling them. Also, if there's any speech, speech pathology, like all of these things, linguistics and communication and the engagement and you know, exchanging ideas through language are at the core of it. And so linguists make the best everything. So you don't have to only think about the academy. You don't only have to think about the classroom. There's so many other things that you can do. And I just urge you to explore, make mistakes, get messy, like do the thing and figure it out, because it's going to all work out. I really believe that.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. What a great quote. I love it. And I'm going to steal it. So thank you very much for that.
You don't have to steal it. I will give it freely.
So talking about that, I am really curious to know what you think your linguistic training has done for you in this job. Like, you talked before about having a position where you were doing a lot of data management, and that seems very natural to me as a linguist, right? That's all we do as linguists. We're looking at data, we're arranging it, we're taxonomizing it, we're making it mean something, right? Take a big pile of data and then turn it into something. So how do you feel your linguistic skills translated into the work that you've been doing at Boys and Girls Clubs?
It's so funny because when people ask me this, I feel like it seems very tangentially related. But when I look at what I do, I feel like it's so clear.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm going to talk about my dissertation for a second, because my dissertation was informed by my work at Boys and Girls Club. So my dissertation is a mixed methods, and I'm looking at a language change in progress. Or I looked at a language change in progress in DC. When you think about it's the variation between Maryland and Maryland. So you hear a lot of speakers in the area, they'll be like their parents and the Uria, Maryland, the Curry out. So this vowel centralization. But I'm also that was the quantitative part in looking at what factors are driving this variable usage, right? Like what's happening here? Mm-hmm. Why are we seeing some speakers are centralizing and others are not? And then the qualitative part of my was language around change. And so it's really the focus of as we know, DC is most definitely gentrifying. At its peak, it was about 75 to almost 80% African-American. In this last census, it's now 40%. And so Chocolate City is no longer demographically chocolate in the same way, but culturally very much still chocolate. And I love that. Instead of focusing on gentrification and kind of its current effects, I really looked at what I call this origin point, this point of origin. And so I looked at the 1968 riots, and I looked at narratives from these three older women who were younger at the time. One was 11. One was 14 and one was 18 at the time. And the stories that they told about how the riots affected them and their families, but also the community, and really thinking about, you know, the Black population was so prosperous before that time and really didn't rebound in the same kind of way after the riots. And then, of course, you had the heroin and crack epidemics. And then DC was the murder cap. Like, you had all of these things that kept happening, and they specifically, I won't say targeted, but they most definitely disproportionately affected the Black community of DC. And so we didn't see it. And so then, of course, we had, you know, spaces where property values plummeted, and we had these developers come in and you know, buy up the property. And now we have these, you know, $1 million one bedroom condos. But I really focused on that piece. But how, when I was doing these interviews and getting folks to do data, I started with the folks that I had the easiest access to, and that was the people that I worked with, because many of the people in my organization are from DC and have our second, third, fourth generation Washingtonians. And so they were interested, you know, I had the biggest support system. Everyone at my job was cheering me on to get this degree. And so I had folks who were lined up to do interviews for my doctoral work. And so part of what I told them was, I just want you to get on here and tell stories. I literally want to just talk to you and hear about stories about growing up in DC. And ultimately, what I realized is that's exactly what I do in my job, right? I believe that numbers sell, stories tell. But in order to get a complete picture of both of those things, you have to have the data. because I got to convince you that I'm doing the work, but you have to have the story so I can compel you about the importance of the work. Mm-hmm. And so I literally look at data and some of the skills that I've learned, you know, statistics and analyzing data in my linguistics work, and kind of my linguistics career, but also storytelling and how mm-hmm. we frame mm-hmm. a narrative and how we present a narrative and what do we highlight and what do we put in the foreground and what do we put in the background, right? And I think that's where I really focus on that's where my linguistics, the work that I do, the sociolinguistic mm-hmm. work that I do, I think that's what I've learned how to really tell a story in a way that can really compel and move the needle. And I feel like and I do that work all the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so when I think about what does a course look like, if I had to define my work and I put it into a course, I think it would be sociolinguistics 101 with a focus on narrative analysis.
Yeah.
Like that would be my job title.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I'm thinking about an interview that I did a couple of podcasts ago with Alex Botti, who's a journalist. And we talked about this in terms of political discourse. And I think mm-hmm. what you're saying is completely related. Like the way you succeed with any kind of political discourse is that storytelling, right? Being able to relate to people and using the language and the words and perhaps even the pronunciation that is going to make you seem authentic and real. Mm-hmm. And in the United States, like the Republicans, the right has been very, very good at that. And the Democrat side less so, but I think they're catching up now. Like it's about time, but it's a very under-examined part, I think, of mm-hmm. that kind of discourse that happens. And as you say, like linguists are really good at this. There should be more linguists who are involved in this kind of persuasive discourse that's out there. Like there are ways that you can be successful with it that people are not going to recognize unless they're linguists and they have looked at it in the way that you did for your dissertation, like looking at how types of language, ways of human communication are relevant to the people that you want to communicate to. So I think there should be way more linguists involved in doing that kind of work. It would be good for everyone.
Everyone. We would all just be so much better, but this is the start. We're going to see the influx now. We're going to see the increase because of today. We are putting mm-hmm. the charge out there. We want everyone, all the linguists listening, please accept the charge. Get out there. Change the world. Please, please, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how you change the world, right? With language. You have to start with the language.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Are there more linguists who are now employed at where you are at Boys and Girls Clubs?
Not that I know of in my local organization, right? So mm-hmm. our local organization, we are in the DMV area, but then there's, you know, there are organizations all across the country mm-hmm. and internationally that support our military family. So in my organization, not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean I think some of them are inspired by the work I do. So hopefully, if nothing else, anytime I have a public event or anytime I talk about language, they're always there. So I think they're undercover linguists and they don't know it yet, but they do love it and they want to learn more and keep eating it up. And so that's my job. My job is always is the exposure and mm-hmm. the excitement around it. Because I think that's the education, right? It doesn't happen in a semester's course or a 4-year degree all the time. Sometimes it's that 30-minute, you know, listening to the podcast or going to an event around linguistics or reading an article that's, you know, accessible to a non-linguist. Like those are the moments that matter. And so if that's the case, if that's how I'm going to define our budding linguists, I think I have a lot of them at my job. Mm-hmm. And I think in my communities, in the communities in which the circles in which I am in, but formally, not that I know of.
Okay. I think one of the other benefits of having someone amazing like you is that now you're an example to other nonprofits to say, hey, you should hire linguists because they're really, really good at this kind of work. Look at everything that, you know, you have done and what other people can accomplish. Because as with most people, lots of folks do not even know what linguists are, what they do, mm-hmm. what they study, and what kind of skills they can bring. So just being an example in your space is really important.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I, you know, if there's ever a doubt, anyone listening, whether you are a linguist or you're thinking about hiring a linguist, please call me so I can convince you that you are making the right choice 100% of the time.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. I will be putting your LinkedIn link in the show notes. So it's good to know people can contact you if they want
Please
to.
Please do.
Yeah. So as you've gone through this, you mentioned just before we started talking that you had had some additional challenges as well, as people do in their lives. So can you, you said you'd had a stroke. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So this is one of my, I won't say favorite stories to tell because that sounds like I'm just super excited about it, but I think it's one of the most defining moments in who I am, and how my work came about, the way I currently look at things. So in 2016, May 2016, I had just done my oral exams. And I remember being in the room and I passed and we had a beautiful conversation. And I remember all through that time, like through May and June, I had been having just little headaches. And I was like, why am I having this weird headache? And then it kind of went away. And in July, July 17th, 2016, to be exact, around 1 o'clock, I literally had the biggest headache. And I remember my friend was at the house and my speech started to slur. And I was like, well, it's because I have, and I was making up all the excuses. Like, I remember figuring this all out. I was like, well, now I have a toothache and that's why I'm slurring my speech. And he was like, nah, something else is going on. I was like, yeah, I know this toothache is causing my face. He's like, your face looks weird. I was like, oh yeah, it's because of my tooth. And I'm like, this doesn't even make sense. And so then I tried to stand up and I literally fell over.
Oh my God, that's so scary. That's terrifying.
It is. It was. And so in my, the essence of who I am, if you know me, like the essence and how I describe myself and probably one of the adjectives people will use to describe me is intelligent, right? And so one of my biggest life fears is Alzheimer's or dementia, because that's my brain being affected is so scary to me. And so I'm literally sitting and I'm like, oh my God, I've forgotten how to get up because I couldn't get up. Mm-hmm. And then when I got up, I fell over. And at that point, he's like, I'm calling 911. I was like, I don't think we need it. He's like, no, I'm calling 911. And I'm so glad he did. And I remember, I blanked out. I don't remember the ambulance ride. I don't remember any of that. But I remember when I got into ER and the ER doctor was there and he came into the room. It was two of them. And he came into the room. He says, hey, we have to give you this medicine. It's called TPA. And there's a 6% chance of brain damage. And I remember in my slurred speech and all, and I'm telling him, I was like, well, you know, that's a lot. Do you have something that's like 3%? Do you have something more experimental? Because 6% is a lot and I can't afford for my brain to get damaged. Now, mind you, you only have a certain window to get this administered. And I'm literally trying to, in my slurred speech, have a conversation with the doctor. And there's another doctor in there because when you give verbal consent, you have to have two, you have to have the person you're consenting to and a witness. And so they're looking at me like, lady, do you realize like you have a blood clot caught in your brain right now? You probably, you know, and I'm asking all these questions. And I remember him saying, no, this is the only medicine we have. And I remember telling him, I said, okay, I give my consent, but please be really careful. And I know he was looking at me like, is she serious? But I was so, cause it was so important to me.
Sure.
And I remember, the next day, one of my colleagues came to visit me and I was talking and in my mind, I'm just moving about. I'm talking fine. And he's like, are you okay? He's like, you know, he's like, you're labored trying to talk. And it progressively got worse, over the next few days. And, now mind you, I had just finished my orals, but I was also in the middle of data collection. I was working with the Corpus of Online Regional African-American Language, the CORAL project, with Tyler Kendall and that team. And so I was doing data collection and all of a sudden, like, I can't talk. I mean, I could talk, but you could barely understand me. And my voice was like, I could barely like get my voice up above this volume. Like it was really, really bad. Because it was tough. And I remember that was really so disconcerting. Mm-hmm. And the stroke happened on the right side of my brain. So it affected the left side of my body and I'm left-handed.
Oh, so wow. That also, oh, my God. Okay.
And I remember my mom sitting next to me in ICU, and I told her, give me a piece of paper. And I because I was like, I need to write my name. And I remember her giving me that piece of paper, and all I could do, I could barely scribble. But I remember that paper being filled up with scribbles until I wrote something that resembled my name. And I just, that road to recovery was really, really long. I was in therapy for a couple of months. I was in physical therapy, just to make sure, you know, my gait and how I walk and just my balance. I was in occupational therapy because once again, there was a lot of muscle atrophy in my right, in my left hand. So like holding a pencil, like I literally was drawing clouds and tracing the letters on a page. And then I was in speech therapy, and I literally, everything that you do in beginning in linguistics 101, right? Like you're like articulating the different sounds and learning about the bilabials versus, you know, the alveolars, like literally I'm in therapy going ma 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 pa 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 ta ta, like one of the toughest moments, and not because it was tough to go through it physically, but more so emotionally and mentally. Like right, I'm at the ape. I'm like about to go into my dissertation, and I'm collecting data, and I'm on this National Science Foundation project, and I'm like living the dream. And then all of a sudden, like all of that comes crashing down. And I think it's really, that was really, really tough. But I think the other thing that that taught me, and this is the reason that this is so important to me, is, so I told you that my daughter had, you know, she contracted meningitis. And so part of that was when you, meningitis is essentially poisonous blood, and it was running through her brain. So it caused brain damage. And part of the brain damage, what ended up happening was, you know, speech and cognitively, she had some severe delays in some areas. And so, and her speech was also developmentally different. And so I remember when I was coming from the hospital, and I had been out of the hospital for a few days, and I wanted to take a little thank you gift to my office for all of their support. I went to drop my daughter off at camp. She was at summer camp for Boys and Girls Clubs. And there's a Dunkin' Donuts that I would run in and grab coffee sometimes. And so it wasn't like I was new to this specific location. And I remember being in line. And remember, I'm telling you, at this point, I'm still having a lot of speech challenges. And somebody behind me was like, can you hurry up, retard?
Oh, my God.
I'm a very smart person, right? And so the only reason, you know, there was no other, there's nothing physically that gave him any indication of any kind of diminished cognitive ability or anything like that. And it was my speech. Because you heard me talk differently and express myself differently, you felt that I was not able to function in this world in the way that you think I should. And so that moment made me realize in the world in which my daughter would have to navigate. And so when I think about linguistic diversity, linguistic appreciation, linguistic discrimination, it was that moment that helped me see it so much differently. Like I saw, you know, she was still young at the time, so I didn't see the effects. And as she's getting older, you know, I think the world is in most people in the world are much more understanding of different abilities. You still have some people who aren't, and you still have that jerk who was behind me at Dunkin' Donuts. You still have those people in the world, but I appreciate that moment because it gave me a different appreciation. That guy's still a jerk, and he will always be a jerk, right? But I think it helped me realize I have so much work to do. And so the work that I do with African-American language is so critical because our kids disproportionately are being put in special ed because they bring a different linguistic form to the classroom. That does not any kind of way dictate their cognitive, emotional, mental abilities. And I hate that that language becomes equated to that because I'm bringing a different flavor into the classroom. That doesn't mean that every other flavor is better or less than the one that you decide that should be the standard in the classroom. Yeah. And so now my work, that moment when I was in that Dunkin' Donuts, and of course I didn't have the epiphany in that time. But as I was coming out of that, I realized that that was the moment that I said, this work is so critical and I will continue to do this work. I will continue to make the world better for those with different abilities, but also with, you know, who bring different varieties of language to these spaces and where we think it has to be just one variety is acceptable. No, we can coexist and they can bring beautiful flavor and beautiful color to these spaces. And that moment, that adversity one helped me realize so many different things, but at that moment helped shape my work in a very different way than I think any other moment could have done.
Wow. I'm sorry. I'm still sitting here like shocked that someone said that to you. That's incredible. And you have far more restraint than I, cause I probably would have punched that guy right in the face. That's amazing. And I am so glad that you're talking about this because I see this. I think we all do as linguists, we notice it. And it keeps coming up in discussions about public discourse, right? Like there was some situations recently where I saw some folks throwing around the word Ebonics as an insult, right? Like as if it reflected some degraded form of English. And that, as you say, like it somehow would reflect less cognitive effort on the part of the people who are speaking it. And it's all just, there's so much prejudice built into it, just automatic prejudice. And it's similar to other conversations that are going around right now, like, you know, people who have Spanish as their main language and who speak English as a second language, that somehow they're stupid or they can't learn English or something like that. I think people who are deaf or hard of hearing have faced that as well, right? Like that sign language, ASL isn't a real language, right? It's just gestures or something like that. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it is changing over time, but there's a lot of work to be done to educate people that every variety of English is beautiful and valid and all the rest of it. And we just need to accept people a little bit more. Wow. Amazing. It's especially weird when you see it and you understand immediately, like, what's at the bottom of this? Oh, it's racism, right? Like, that is really what is at the bottom of it. The othering of people and looking for any excuse to say there's something wrong with you.
Yep.
You know, you're not fully human. That's just incredible. I'm also glad you mentioned Smitherman. And when I was at Berkeley and I was teaching a sociolinguistics class as part of my graduate student, we used a lot of her work. And I remember even back then, this is ancient history, right? Like 90s. It was eye-opening for a lot of the students, for the white students, I will say, going through it. And I think it really helped them. And I hope that kind of research and writing is accessible to students at the university level so they can learn about it while they're learning about lots of other things as well. That sociolinguistic education, as you were saying, has to be part of any linguistics education. You know, sociolinguistics is linguistics. It's not just the squishy part of it that doesn't really have any science behind it, which was definitely the attitude when I was in graduate school. I think it's changed a lot since then, but it is so crucial to everyday life in the United States, and especially to the political discourse that's happening right now.
Oh, especially to that. And of course, you know, that could be a whole different kind of conversation, especially as we look at now, two different, we have a white man and a black woman, right? Mm-hmm. And we think about qualifications and we think about the way we use language and who gets access to what and who can say what and in what space is it okay and what space is it aggressive and what space is it just, you know, the way that a person talks. And like, you know, I don't want to get into that whole thing, but I think one of the things that that even this space and also going back to Smitherman and being a black woman, you know, and in linguistics, I think those kind of my identity as a black woman in linguistics has very much shaped the work I do in linguistics. Right. Mm-hmm. And the way I ultimately use linguistics. But going back to Smitherman, so in 2006, when I went to Michigan State, I was super excited to work with her. And I actually took her African-American language seminar. And that was the first time I had taken a full course on African-American language. But the more important reason that class was pivotal was because that was the first time I had a Black professor.
Mm-hmm.
I loved everything about my experience at Georgetown. I love most of my experience at Georgetown, right? And I had opportunities. I had workshops and things like that. But when taking a full course, that was the first time that I had had a Black professor.
Yeah.
Because in the linguistics department, one, we didn't have our linguistics department is very much, it's pretty white.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had, you know, there's been some amazing scholars that have come out of the department, a lot of beautiful women of color who are my mentors now, Jesse Greaser, most definitely. And we just had, we hung out not too long ago. But thinking about these women who are, you know, these scholars who are doing amazing things. But when I came out of that, when I came out of Georgetown and I went to Michigan State and to be in her classroom, I felt the difference. I felt, mm-hmm. I saw the difference of how the class was run. I saw the difference on kind of just how she looked at it and also how she mm-hmm. taught the concept and the skills, because she wasn't teaching from, you know, what others have told her and contextualizing. This was lived experiences.
Yeah.
And it resonated differently. And I remember, also, well, I talked about Jesse, but I also remember Mackenzie Price coming and taking mm-hmm. me and we would have conversations about what does it mean to be a part and what does it mean to do this work? And so I appreciated having those mentors when I got back to Georgetown, you know, a few years later, but in that space of coming from the undergrad and my master's program, I didn't have that. And so Geneva was so influential and she gave me my first publication. We did a book chapter together that was in honor of her former advisor, Richard Bailey. And we looked at educational intervention in African-American language over the last 50 years at that point. So this was about 15, 20 years ago almost. So, but looking 50 years from that. And so really it was eye-opening to me because I had never really done a survey of the literature in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And understood, I knew about some of the programs that have, of course, the Bridge program. And of course, Julie Sweetland's work had just come out from Georgetown at that time. And so it was interesting to look at some of the what was coming out, but to go back to looking at Charles Hurst and his work and kind of this idea that there was a language disorder because, you know, the Black students spoke differently, so mm-hmm. they needed to be fixed, right?
Yeah.
And so it made me see the work differently because it was coming from someone who looks like me and who, you know, of course our generations are different, but who had lived some of these experiences and was foundational in this work.
Mm-hmm.
And so having her as my first Black professor, but then coming into a space where, you know, when Mackenzie graduated and Jesse graduated, and for a while I was the only one.
Yeah.
Right. Like, what does yep. it mean to be the only one and to mm-hmm. own that space? It's tough. Right. So I had a lot of opportunity. I got to do a lot of amazing things because I was the only one. And also I think at this point, I want to be very clear, decisions that I earned those things. And it wasn't because I was the only one in the space and there was nobody else to call. I earned those things. And I think that's really important, especially mm-hmm. as the political discourse that we have going on right now, right? No one is yep. giving us anything. I earned the space. I made space and I earned to be, and I deserve to be in that space. So I think that's a really important distinction. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that openly and assertively and loudly. But in that space, because I got to do some really amazing things. Talking about the DC accent and being in these circles, I had access to, I think there was a different level of trust because I was Black, right? And so people mm-hmm. welcomed me into their homes. I got to talk to judges, but I also got to talk to, you know, a couple of people who decided that they were going to get into, you know, they dealt drugs as their mm-hmm. Profession. But what they told me is like, this is a life that I would, if I could do it all again, I wouldn't, but I know nothing else. Mm-hmm, and they talked mm-hmm. about like just kind of the socioeconomic status of their families and why this had to be so important. But I also, you know, I also got to speak to educators and like why this work is so important. So when it exposed me to a lot being the only one. But the other thing that is, there's a lot of emotional, and I became the voice of all Black people. And I was like, no, that's, mm-hmm. I can be my mm-hmm. voice and I can talk about my experiences, and I can talk about how I see some commonalities, but my experiences are not going to be the ubiquitous Black experience. So please don't look at it like that. They may not be just unique to me, but they're not, they don't necessarily have to be everyone's experience. And I had to do some education in that space, because I don't think it came out of a place of, I think it really came out of a place of true ignorance and not understanding that just because, you know, because all white women don't have the same experience, right? All, you know, all Asian men don't have the same experience. And so why would all Black people, and then specifically all Black women, have the same experience? And I think that was the moment that I realized, like, I had to do that work. But also I got a lot of opportunity to kind of speak on that very thing about being the only one in the room and about what assumptions do we bring? What biases are we bringing linguistically and beyond that, socially, culturally, all the things. And how do we combat that? Like, how do we really look at that and say, you know what, let me take a step back. Let me pause and say, how am I showing up in this space? And would I want someone to show up for me the way I'm showing up for this person in this space? And it really made me think about that work. And when I started, and I, what it also made me, it forced me to do is I had amazing women mentors, because I think you have to find, you know, women are going to support you. I found that the women in the linguistic space, but then specifically I sought out Black scholars, and then I sought out Black women, because the Black linguist space is very small. Unfortunately, being a Black linguist, you are a, you know, we're growing and we have some amazing scholars who are up and coming, who have arrived, who are here, and they're pulling others up as they continue to climb, but we still have a ways to go. I'll give a shout out to, I think there's some amazing, if you want to call them allies in the work. I had the amazing opportunity to work with Walt on his the Talking Black in America series, and I specifically got to work on the last episode, the last installment on social justice. And what I love about that is it's all of the upcoming, it's all of the, what I call, it's the newbies in the field, right? Sharice King, Sabria Fisher, Nicole Holiday, like Jesse Greaser, me, and they're passing the torch to us to carry on, right? So you see Sanja and Tracy and John Rickford and John Bond, and they're passing the torch to say, take this work, do this work. You, there's so much more to be done. And, you know, we've set the way for you, but continue to forge on and make the path wider, make it greater. And I absolutely love that. Because this work, when you are the only one in a space, or you feel like you're the only one, it can be lonely, right? But you're not alone. And I think that's about being the only one in the space, but also for those who are listening to this while you're in, and I don't care what color, what gender, you know, where you are in your journey. I want to give a little piece of advice, if you will. So for those who are the only one in the space, how do you make that space better because of you being there? And how do you educate in that space? But also, what can you take from that space to make you better at, in that space, right? What can you take as you move to other spaces? So I want you to really think about that. And the second thing is, I want to offer a little piece of advice, and I'll kind of tell one final story, if you don't mind, Laurel. Is this is a lonely journey, but you're not alone. And I learned that very, very clearly. When I was writing my dissertation, I had a lot of people, I had a lot of cheerleaders, but the mechanics of, and it's just like if you have a trainer, right? Look at Simone Biles, right? She's the greatest of all time. That doesn't mean she doesn't have a coach. And what I realized as I was writing this, when I started writing my dissertation and I was doing it in earnest, when I made that decision, like, I got to finish this thing and I got to finish it quick. I actually had seen a Facebook ad for a program called Write the Damn Dissertation. And I went to their free workshop, and I was like, oh, I can do all. And so the founder, her name's Dr. Amy. She gave us all these tips. I was like, oh, I can do this by myself. Child, I ain't do nothing. I didn't write nothing. I took the advice. So I was like, oh yeah, this is great. And so, you know, Facebook algorithms as they were, they read my mind. And they're like, okay, you keep saying you're going to do something, but you ain't done nothing. So a couple of months later, the ad popped back up. And I was like, you know what? At the beginning of the year, new me, you know all that, how it goes. I decided to join the workshop in the spring or in that January. And I signed up immediately. And it was the best decision for me because it gave me a community. And the program is specifically designed for women and those who identify as women in their doctoral journeys, specifically in the dissertation process. And it was all that I needed, right? It was helping me understand that this is really hard and that as women, there are other obstacles that we may have that mm-hmm. our male counterparts may not. And how do we handle that? How can we lean on each other to do the thing? So I joined that program in January 2022. I defended my dissertation in May 2022 because it helped me develop that muscle of writing. It helped me, do all the things. But the other thing is what I realized is I love this work and I'm so glad I had an amazing coach who poured into me. And so I decided to coach women, and so I'm now a coach for that program because mm-hmm. I know what it is to be the only one, whatever that mm-hmm, one mm-hmm. is, whatever that X is, woman, working, full-time working person, a mother, Black. I know what it is to be the only one in the room, but I also know what it is to do the really hard thing and feel like you're alone in doing the really hard thing. And this sense of community and women who identify in some kind of parts of my own intersectional identity and being able to support them in the way that I was poured into is so important. And so as I know we've come to our time, but as I finish up, I really want to say, find your community, embrace that. And the piece of advice, especially for my young scholars, find data that speaks to you and find an advisor or a support that will speak up for you, because there will be spaces that you will not be in those rooms. And I thank Natalie, because I know there was times where she advocated for me in ways I would never be in those spaces. And she advocated to make sure that I had what I needed to get through this process. And then I thank, Tyler and Natalie for the LCDC work and the CORAL work and creating that data space, because that data has spoken to me. It continues to speak to me. Mm-hmm. I love my dissertation data. I love the research, but that data spoke to me in a way that made me so connected to the work. And those people spoke up for me in rooms that kept me connected to the field and gave me a way out.
Yeah, that's so good. And it's a message that we have echoed throughout the linguistics career launch and throughout the podcast. As you were saying, it's a lonely journey, but you don't got to do it alone, right? There's people who will help mm-hmm. you. You got to ask them and people will be willing to help. And the linguistics community in general of folks within academia, but also outside of it, are so happy to help, right? Like, look at you, you're doing coaching, you're offering to speak to people with advice. I think we all feel like we want to give something back so that nobody feels like they're the only one and that they're all by themselves and that there's no help for them.
100%. Couldn't have said it better. This work is, it's necessary work. It's hard work. Sometimes it can be very othering work. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to do it. And it can be lonely work. But please know that our community, and I believe the linguistics community is strong. We are here to support and to lift up, because we are better when we all can do the work and do it beautifully and excel in it. And I think that the only way we're going to do that is as a team.
Absolutely. That's great. I think that is a great place to leave this. Thank you so much, Minnie. You have just dispensed. You're an inspiration, first of all. Your words are inspirational, and you've offered just by your example so much help that you are able to give to other people, and the encouragement that we should all stick together. So I will put your LinkedIn profile in the notes. People can contact you if they want to, or through Write the Damn Dissertation as well. So again, thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you so much, Laura, for the invitation. And I am just so happy to be here. And I once again am super, super grateful to have been here a couple of years ago and now to be back and chat with you. It has been a great experience for me. So thank you.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.